Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Abraham Lincoln deeply believed in personal liberty, and that was the core of his governing philosophy. But it didn't just have to do with individual rights. It also had to do with the ability for one to fulfill their economic destiny. In order to do so, even before the Civil War, he supported large infrastructure projects so that people could climb the ladder with federal support. He had visions of a country linked by railroads running ocean to ocean, canals turning small towns into huge cities, and public works bridging farmers to market. Today's guest is John Wasick, author of the book Lincolnomics, which tracks Lincoln from his time in the 1830s as a young Illinois state legislator, pushing for internal improvements, through his work as a lawyer representing the Illinois Central Railroad in the 1840s, to his presidential fight for the Transcontinental Railroad, and his support of land-grant colleges that educated a nation. To Lincoln, infrastructure meant not only roads and bridges and canals he shepherded as a lawyer and a public servant, but also much more. And some have connected Lincoln's infrastructure projects to Eisenhower's interstate highways and FDR's social amenities. So in this episode, we're going to look at Lincoln's championing of the Transcontinental Railroad and pivotal public works preceding it, how infrastructure both hindered and enabled the Confederate and Lincoln-led Union armies during the Civil War, Lincoln's support for land-grant colleges, the foundation for today's public universities, and Lincoln's dedication to infrastructure, among them the sketch of a town he surveyed, and a design he created and patented. So when you're looking at somebody's legacy, even though he's often understood as a moral leader, you really can't separate economics from the equation. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with John Wasick. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
There's always new things to learn about Abraham Lincoln. And one thing I didn't know that your book brings attention to is that he had plans for a town. And Lincoln was far too humble to call it Lincolnopolis, but this fits into grand infrastructure designs he had. So can you tell me about the town that Lincoln sketched out?
Well, this is something that almost nobody knows about Lincoln. And I discovered this pretty much by accident. I was going through the archives of the Lincoln Library in Springfield, Illinois, and discovered these plans for a town called Huron, as in Lake Huron. And he had platted out this town. And the whole idea was it was connected to his first big infrastructure idea was to build a canal from Springfield, Illinois, his hometown, to the Illinois River. The other way of getting there was the Sangamon River, which is just a horrible way to get there. It was navigable most of the year. And Lincoln had this as a campaign plank to build this canal to get elected to the Illinois General Assembly. So he literally platted this town, and it was going to be one of the first transit-oriented developments. It was never built. Neither was the canal. But it was this really important footnote in history. It was an urban planner.
So I'm curious, when we get into the whole world of Lincoln and his legacy with infrastructure and economics and how you argue this is an inextricable part of his legacy, what did it mean to have plans for infrastructure in the early 19th century? Now, today we think of roads, rural broadband, interstate highway systems and the like, but This is in the early 1800s. This isn't too far away from when people think of large infrastructure, they might think of Roman roads or huge Gothic cathedrals that are in the empire's capital. But in the hinterlands, there's really not that much at all. And the provinces, unless the army is going out there, they're almost completely left to their own devices. So to young man Lincoln growing up on, which is almost a frontier in the early 19th century, what did the infrastructure mean at this time?
Well, let's start in the 1830s. So there are two debates raging. One, should federal government pay for infrastructure, which meant roads, canals, ports, and eventually railroads. But there was no road system to speak of that was viable and what we would think was a decent road system. There was the so-called National Road, which went through the Cumberland Gap, which ended surprisingly around Vandalia, Illinois. And it didn't go much further. And they weren't thinking of big roads. They were thinking about, well, how do we connect, say, the port of New York to the Great Lakes? So they built the Erie Canal, 1825, that connected them to as far as Chicago, which at that time wasn't much of anything. It wasn't even a city. It was just a big swamp. So, you know, a lot of the explorers from the 1670s, the French, Joliet and Marquette said, well, you know, this is a great place for a canal because there was a portage that you could take across a very muddy stretch of swampland that would get you to the Illinois River and then the Mississippi, but it's just a horrible way to travel. So at that time, they were mostly thinking about canals and ports because, you know, the interstate was, you know, not coming along until the 1950s. The railroads weren't really coming along until the 1840s, and they did happen. But at the first real, you know, what they call the era of good feelings was about canals and ports.
And when Lincoln is involved in supporting internal improvements to Illinois, and then later on, he's representing the Illinois Central Railroad in the 1840s, support for large-scale infrastructure, it's not a new thing, but from what I understand in history, it's almost always linked, number one, to the movement of troops. This is the purpose of the construction of the Roman roads. I'm a historian of the Ottoman Empire, and sultans had grand ideas of linking the Caspian Sea to the Black Sea with a canal with two rivers that go north of them up in the Volga region. It's about the movement of troops, and if trade is a byproduct of that, it's a happy byproduct, and we'll help that for economic growth. But number one, moving troops so we can quickly go around and defend our borders and expand if necessary. Is this how infrastructure is framed at this time and how Lincoln understands it, or is it something different?
Well, two things were happening. One, after the War of 1812, White House is burned down, and troops had a real tough time getting around. So President Monroe later says, you know, we really should be thinking about better roads, better ports, better canals, things like that. But the main debate was that they really couldn't do it on the federal level because they thought it was unconstitutional. The Constitution doesn't specifically state that you can't do it. It was just the feeling was that the federal government shouldn't be involved in a federalist sort of system. So that kind of impeded the growth. Nevertheless, the early sort of version of the Army Corps of Engineers was out mapping ports for strategic purposes. And this, of course, was a main concern. But as commerce expanded westward and, you know, settlement went across the Appalachians and well into the Midwest, or what they called the Great Northwest at that time, or the Northwest Territory, they started to think, well, you know, we could move a lot of goods from the north to the south, from the west to the east, not from the east to the west yet. But, you know, how do we get these things, say, from New York City or from Chicago to New Orleans? Well, you had to take the river route, and it was awful before the construction of the Illinois and Michigan Canal finished in 1848. So the first inspiration was actually for military moving the troops across this vast continent, which extended pretty much to the Mississippi, and then, of course, to open up markets.
What was it like then if there was a pushback against a federal sort of infrastructure project, if you had a canal system that went across states? Was it like a commercial articles of confederation where each state has its own link of the system, and then when it meets at the border, they'll work something out, but it's an ad hoc arrangement? Or was there any sort of national oversight of projects like these prior to the Civil War?
So this was one of the greatest debates prior to the Civil War. The Whig Party, which Lincoln was a member of before the Republican Party was formed, was very pro what they call internal improvements, meaning that every state should have some means of transporting goods and people. And that mostly meant canals and later railroads. But the prevailing force in Washington throughout that period, except for two very short-lived Whig presidents, said, no, we really can't do this on a federal level. Let's just let the states do it. And the states were ill-prepared to finance these big projects. 1848, Lincoln makes a speech in his only term in Congress for internal improvements. And it's one of his longest speeches. And he makes the arguments that, hey, if we do all these state improvements and we get, and he's opposing a veto by President Polk, then we can build this infrastructure and it will benefit the entire country. So, you know, this is a basic Whig platform of internal improvements. You know, it's going to raise all boats quite literally and get people around and move goods and services. And Lincoln is a big proponent of that before he really even talks about slavery. So this is one of his first big political ideas.
What's his grand vision of infrastructure that he gives in the speech and other writings of this time?
Well, he's making a big argument for, of course, his, one of his favorite projects, the Illinois-Michigan Canal. He scarcely mentions railroads. He does later. There's a big convention in 1847 called the Rivers and Ports and Canals Convention. It's huge. It comes to Chicago. Chicago has like 10,000 people there, and some 6,000 people arrive, and there's some big shots like Horace Greeley. And Lincoln is a backbencher. He's very unknown. But he gets up and he says, you know, we have to support this national idea of doing infrastructure that is opposed by Polk and the Democrats. So that really pushes it along. It becomes a very popular idea and it gains traction, but it doesn't gain enough traction until the railroads start really getting built in the 1840s.
And can you tell me about his involvement in this? Because he is involved in Illinois and other places. And do railroad networks have the same challenges that canals do, where they're contained within a state, but interstate railroad lines have challenges connecting these massive systems?
Well, the whole concept of the, you know, transcontinental or interstate rail system really didn't start to take off until the 1850s. Now, Lincoln was a big champion of what became the Illinois Central Railroad, him and Stephen Douglas, and it literally connected Illinois to other places. So the Mississippi River eventually crossed the Mississippi, the southern part of the state, which connected it to the southern states, the Ohio River. I mean, it was a big deal. And by 1860, it was the longest railroad in the world. So he championed that in the late 1830s with Douglas. And it was a game changer. And, you know, Illinois Central eventually became this, you know, Chicago to New Orleans Railroad, not until after the Civil War. But what became this link in the Transcontinental Railroad, because the idea was, hey, you can take a train from New York all the way eventually to San Francisco or, you know, Los Angeles. But that was really something that gained traction in the 1850s.
So at this, even in early parts of his career, he seems to have an expansive idea of the economy of federal infrastructure projects at a time when many others don't believe this. But Lincoln's background at this time wouldn't suggest this. In the 1830s, 1840s, he's still a rural lawyer. He's writing on a circuit. Granted, he's very self-educated. He's reading Euclid when he's on horseback. But at this time, 20s, 30s, I think he's still getting into county-level wrestling tournaments and beating them thanks to his long lives and his Marfan syndrome and strength by chopping wood all day. But someone would look at him and think he's a country lawyer, he's a country bumpkin, but he has an idea of national infrastructure. So where do you think this comes from, even at this early age?
Well, you know, as I dug deeper into his writings and also into his so many biographies that really try to get at the psychology of Lincoln, which is elusive at best, he really had a deep-seated concern of linking rural markets to global markets. And he experienced this personally in two flatboat trips, one from southern Indiana down the Ohio, down the Mississippi to New Orleans, and then later one from Springfield that went up to the Illinois and then down the Mississippi to New Orleans. And he experienced what this meant to his area. And that formed the campaign plank of his first run for the Illinois General Assembly. It was infrastructure. He said, hey, we got to connect our farmers to New Orleans and then be able to bring up other things like molasses and sugar, and then be able to transport it to the East Coast and eventually the West Coast. So he felt it very deeply because he personally experienced the problems of transportation of that time.
Specifically, you're saying both down the Mississippi and then up through the Great Lakes and to the East Coast? Okay. And one other thing, too, with this, you hit on a lot of really interesting topics. And this is something that, on the one hand, if listeners don't know the details of, can sound boring of, oh, canals, infrastructure, the Midwest. But on the other hand, if you do understand it right, is the entire key to basically the global economy and why America has certain geographic advantages that if any entity were on its geography, almost couldn't help but become a global superpower because of the incredibly fertile land in the interior of the United States, that if the rivers are utilized properly and linked up to the other large trading ports, have the longest navigable rivers in the world, essentially. In a place like Africa, there are so many waterfalls that you simply can't send ships down it easily. So economic development is part of the reason why it's harder in Africa. In Russia, too, much of the rivers are frozen most of the year, so you can't send things in the taiga for about 6 months. But with the Mississippi and the Missouri, you have thousands and thousands and thousands of miles with incredibly arable land where you can grow crops in ways that you can't in most of the rest of the world that, with done correctly, can go to almost anywhere else. So you can't help but almost become an agricultural superpower. But at this time in the 1840s, 1850s, was the Mississippi and Missouri, were they basically not navigable due to all the eddies and offshoots and things? Or Midwesterners mostly landlocked? Or what was it like for them that Lincoln was trying to contend with?
Well, before the railroad era, it was the only route to get to New Orleans, which was probably the first really major global port in the United States outside of the East Coast. And New Orleans was, well, of course, shipping a lot of cotton and human beings, which Lincoln witnessed and changed his mind on slavery, of course. But you have to envision a country that, you know, once you hit the Mississippi, you're not going much further. The Missouri, as Jefferson discovered, kind of stops in the Rocky Mountains. You have to do this incredible, god-awful portage to get over to the Snake and then the Columbia, you know, the Lewis and Clark story. But, you know, this whole vision of infrastructure is really to facilitate getting people and goods from one place to another. And it was a real issue. And I discovered in doing this research that even the roads were terrible until the interstate system was built. The national highway system was just wretched. So they had to address these issues, but it took a lot of time. It's surprising. And the great miracle was that there was tremendous innovation in the 1830s and 40s. The harvester machine, the steel-bladed plow, it came out of Illinois, and it enabled these farmers to be much more productive. And they discovered how rich the soil was, so they could grow anything in the Midwest. But the major problem was getting it somewhere else and selling it.
Right. And to get an idea of the challenges of, let's say, the Missouri River, where I live in Kansas City, there's a museum called the Steamboat Arabia Museum. An entire steamboat that sunk in the late 1800s and was found by a family in a field like 3 or 4 miles away from the Missouri River. And people think, well, what's it doing in a field? Well, there used to be an offshoot of the Missouri River, but as the Army Corps of Engineers basically straightened it out, it made it so there aren't all these different eddies and different things shooting off, but it just makes it easier, more navigable. It cleans it up, in a sense. But before it's cleaned up, I mean, it's much harder to do. So this speaks to what these types of projects did and made it easier. And the Steamboat Arabia is a legacy of when it was a much wilder river, in a sense. So can you take me through other things Lincoln is supporting? So we talked about supporting infrastructure projects for canals and the Illinois Central Railroad. The vision of the Transcontinental Railroad, when does this vision begin and how does Lincoln support it in his career?
Well, it really starts in the 1840s when there's a lot more exploration of the West. And of course, you know, 1849, the discovery of gold in California triggered a lot of this. But it was so difficult to get from the East Coast to the West Coast. The water route was terrible and the land route was even worse. But this really spurred the ideas like, well, let's build a railroad from the east to the west. And it was really championed at first on a national level by John Fremont, of the great explorer who named San Francisco the Golden Gate. And he was very popular. And he lost not by very much to John Buchanan, But he put out this idea that this should be part of a national project. And Lincoln adopted that for his 1860 platform and signed the Pacific Railway Acts. There were two laws, the height of the Civil War, which started not only the financing, but the whole land grant idea that, you know, we'll just, all this federal land, we're going to give it to the railroads and they'll use it for the right of way, which, you know, really facilitated it, and then started the whole transcontinental project, which was finished in 1869. And had he lived, he probably would have been there when they drove that golden spike in.
Yeah. And another thing too, so as you described Lincoln, he sees the problem that rural people don't have access to global markets. I wonder if there's another element to how he views these infrastructure projects, because what's interesting in the 21st century is it's become a moral element too, where in 2021, there's a multi-trillion dollar infrastructure project being proposed in the Senate by President Biden. And a lot of it has to do with jobs. And much of it is framed in moral framework that it's going to provide jobs and security to low-income communities. So that's one framework. And if you don't support this, then if you don't support infrastructure and our infrastructure is crumbling, I mean, look at a place that has no infrastructure like Somalia. On the other side, people would say that infrastructure is just a Trojan horse for giving money to different groups to pay off unions, public service sector unions, and all these different things. So there's a politicized moral element to this. Was there something similar to how Lincoln viewed infrastructure? Did he think it's not just about linking communities that are really shut off from the economy to them and leading to the flourishing, but this helps people and there's a moral component to this? How did he understand infrastructure?
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word UNPLUG to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text UNPLUG to 30605.
So Lincoln saw this as a way to promote economic progress. Here was this backwoods guy, becomes a lawyer. He sees the opportunities created by building a railroad or building a canal. It's not just jobs for him. It's the way to, and he uses this word, ascend the economic ladder. So if you're a farmer and all you can do is sell at your local, you know, market, you know, your ability to make more money is limited. But if you're a farmer who can sell your goods to somebody in New Orleans, to a global market, that will give you this greater chance of prosperity. And that was something I found embedded in his thinking that is not really discussed a whole lot. You know, we always focus on slavery and his great speeches and things, and that's fine. But here is this concept that, you know, building these things would help so many different people become more prosperous and in a way that they hadn't been before. Because let's say you're growing, you know, you have hogs and you want, and he literally did this when he was going down to the Mississippi. He would transport hogs down to New Orleans. He would bring goods up from New Orleans to sell in Indiana or Illinois. So that's, you know, we call bilateral trade. I mean, that was a concept that was practiced, but it was so cumbersome to get up that river and across the Illinois and into the Ohio and things like that. It was just awful. But he said, look, all these people who are doing all these things up here in the north or in Ohio, wherever, could access global markets, and it would help them, you know, they wouldn't be, you know, hard scramble farmers like he was probably destined to become as if his father said, Abe, stop reading those books, you know. Mm-hmm.
Another part of infrastructure, this is something that's discussed a lot when we look at a military history of the Civil War. I did a long series with a co-host on different battles in the Civil War. And the thing that happens over and over and over again is infrastructure. It's one of the first wars in which railroads play a critical role for troop transports, for the transport of goods, for setting up an entire logistics networks. And the challenges that the Confederacy has, because it has a scant percentage of the total number of miles of railroad lines that the Union does. So moving goods is simply much more difficult. This bogs them down from very early on in the war effort. And railroads are only one part of it. But it's very much a modern war in a way that even the Mexican-American War wasn't, or wars that happened almost immediately preceding it. So in terms of the discussion in your book of Lincoln and infrastructure, how does this both hinder and enable the Confederate and Lincoln-led Union armies during the Civil War and other things that you talk about in your book?
Well, having this infrastructure, particularly rail, was a huge advantage for the Union. What I discovered, and really a big fan of Grant as well, was that Grant could move all of the supplies down to Cairo, Illinois, which is right at the confluence of the Ohio and the Mississippi. And then, you know, he could ship things down the river. He would have access to the Tennessee and the Cumberland River. So this enabled him to ship all of his troops through the Illinois Central Railroad, which Lincoln had advocated and defended as a lawyer. Very easily from as far north as Chicago, where, you know, there was a meatpacking industry. They were producing all these things that could supply a large army, which enabled Grant to go, you know, into Vicksburg. Vicksburg was a logistical nightmare for him because there was this huge, very well-defended promontory on the Mississippi River. Union gunboats couldn't really get down there, and Grant tried six or seven times to take the town, and it was, you know, up until he finally laid siege to it, it was seen as an epic failure by Grant. But logistically, he managed to get enough supplies down there so that he could position his troops around the city and literally lay siege. But that was one story among many. Lincoln had all the best railroad engineers, one of them, Grenville Dodge, who eventually was, you know, one of the pioneer railroad architects of the Transcontinental Railroad. You know, McClellan worked for the Illinois Central Railroad. Several of his top generals were brilliant at logistics, and they had to build bridges. They had to kind of literally build railroads where the Confederate Army had destroyed them. So that's a big story about the Civil War.
That's interesting. So it's almost like they leave all this infrastructure in their wake, kind of like all the CBs, the construction battalions in the Pacific Theater during World War II are setting up all these landing strips across these islands in the Pacific that kind of create this whole infrastructure system that is even left behind after the war, if that's a fair analogy. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's just what I'm thinking.
Well, logistics is always a problem. I'm reading a book about Stalingrad, the worst battle in human history, and logistical challenges for the German army were tremendous because they ended up fighting a war across a big river in Russia in the middle of winter, and they lost. So that's always something that really comes up as, well, how did they get their troops there? How did they move material? How did they resupply? So this was an issue in the Civil War. And, you know, all of Lincoln's generals, the good ones, would go after the rail junctions first, and then they'd control the railroads, and then they could move their troops wherever they wanted to, and then they'd have to get across the many rivers. So these were all issues that they took on, and they weren't, you know, really good at it at first, and then they figured out what they needed to do.
Well, there's another part of Lincoln's legacy we haven't touched on yet, but it's something near and dear to my heart, and that's land-grant colleges. That's because I am an alumnus of Iowa State University, one of the first land-grant universities, and I have discussed in previous episodes is that the American model of higher education, which is linked to different vocational abilities like engineering and STEM, and not focused on memorizing Latin and reading Horace, is because of the land-grant university. So could you discuss that aspect?
This is one of the great innovations in human history, because prior to the land-grant, the idea was like, well, if you were of the social station or your family had money, you could go to a private college. The land grants, which, you know, Lincoln signed it, the Morrill Act, which established land grants at the height of the Civil War, he saw them as huge networks for raising people's economic ability to make money. So the original concept came out of Illinois. There's an educator by the name of Jonathan Baldwin Turner who produced this document called A Plan for the Industrial University of Illinois. This was, you know, he came up with the idea in 1830s. He kind of promoted it in 1840s, 1850s. Morrill picked it up. It failed at first when he tried to get President Buchanan to sign it. And then finally, Lincoln signed it in the Civil War. It established this magnificent network of research and development. So these land-grant colleges were to promote agricultural productivity, research. The big deal then was like, you know, and they knew this, is that they plant a certain crop for so many years. Cotton was really bad. Tobacco was worse. We'd zap the fertility out of the soil. You couldn't plant anything. So the 19th century remedy was just get more land, plant more crops. And it was a poor one. So they didn't understand how soil worked. So it promoted agricultural research. It promoted what they called, you know, the industrial or mechanical arts, which became engineering, which a growing country needed. We had good inventions, we had good innovation, but we had no way of kind of taking it to the next level, mass producing it, coming up with new ideas. And yeah, I mean, I tried to research how many ideas that came out of land grant colleges that really changed the world. And the list is endless. And they eventually expanded the land grant system to include black colleges, and just about every state got one of these land grant universities, and it literally changed the world. And those systems are still with us today, and they're still important.
Oh yeah. Walking around the campus at Iowa State, they had placards saying at this or that hall, something was created here. So we have the first digital computer, the fax machine, and blue cheese, all of coming to you thanks to the land grant college. And I wrote a self-published book a few years ago called How Iowa Conquered the World. Didn't become a bestseller, unfortunately, but land-grant colleges are one of the features there, that this model of practical research, rather than learning Latin to show that you have the cultural signifiers to be part of the elite class like Harvard and Cambridge did and other places, this model of practical education is now what dominates planet Earth, and it comes out of this, the modest Morrill Land-Grant Act another time. So yeah, big effect right there.
Well, speaking of Iowa, Scott, I have to mention this. So the furthest Lincoln got west was Council Bluffs. And the only reason he got out there is because he had a warrant to purchase some land out there, and he never really picked it up. But he wanted to see what was going on. And he saw, he was visiting Grenville Dodge at the time, who was, you know, one of the great architects of the Transcontinental Railroad, as the terminus for the Transcontinental Railroad. At that time, you know, the railroad got as far as Council Bluffs, didn't get across the Missouri and then, you know, to the Pacific Ocean. But that was the place where Lincoln and Dodge said, hey, you know, this would be a nice place to start, you know, the rest of the railroad system. And he came back and, you know, he put it into law.
All right. So I guess tying the main themes of your book, where you say that Lincoln's view of the right to fulfill one's economic destiny was at the core of his beliefs, that economics isn't something that's siloed from his general view of liberty for all people and the values that we associate with him in the Civil War. What do you hope people understand most from your book when it comes to Lincoln and his legacy?
Well, I want them to get this different picture of Lincoln as an economic philosopher that was very universal. And I actually wrote the book backwards. I started out with the 21st century and looked at some of our, you know, needs for, say, health, education, and climate change, and sort of went back through the 20th century and really how this road system, you know, one of the first east-west roads was the Lincoln Highway, and how he inspired, you know, countless generations from, you know, people of his age to Eisenhower to build the system to create a better America, to lift all boats, and how it's such a universal thing. I mean, you could just say, well, yeah, it is an American ideal, but it's also something that they need in India or China or Southeast Asia or any place where they need infrastructure to improve water or to provide transportation or to get people from one place to another or rural broadband. It's all pretty important. And you really can't have economic progress without the structure in place to do this.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
And one last question with this. When I finished a series on the Civil War with a co-host, we talked about the effects of the Civil War. And one thing that we, I think, agreed on is that it was the most important event in American history because the Revolutionary War determined whether or not the United States would exist, whereas the Civil War determined what kind of nation the United States would become. Would it have the Jeffersonian view of the educated Yale man, citizen farmer, much more de-aggregated, or would it have the Hamiltonian view of a strong federal government that would have a more nationally unified nation? And the Civil War pushed things into the Hamiltonian view. So that's one example is, before the Civil War, you would say the United States are, in the plural form afterwards, the phrase was the United States is, so much stronger federal government. With Lincoln's view of national infrastructure and this type of thing, I would have assumed that, well, because the United States shifted to a more federally centralized nation, because of that, incidentally, infrastructure followed, whereas you seem to say that Lincoln was pushing this before the Civil War. Do you think his push for that and these types of projects that were coming were part of what pushed things into the Hamiltonian view, or was it more the Hamiltonian view prevailed and then national infrastructure followed?
Well, that's a great question. And there's always a tension between what states should do and what the federal government should do. And I understand arguments on both sides that a lot of people felt, and this was the prevailing sentiment popularly during the Jacksonian era in the 1830s, was that the federal government should not have this power. They should not have a national bank. They should not have a national currency, that all the states should have, you know, their own systems. And, you know, we have this problem today. We do have state chartered banks. We do have federally chartered banks. And a lot of people still say, well, you know, the Federal Reserve shouldn't have this much power. And it didn't come along until 1913 with the first, you know, permanent income tax. And that's, of course, being debated again. But Lincoln was the first one to institute an income tax. It was a flat rate of 3% for income over $800 to finance some of these improvements and, of course, to pay for the war. But that concept was very, you know, foreign to a lot of what we call states' rights advocates who did not want the federal government to have that kind of power. But it did mean that there was a national regulation of banks. They issued the greenback. They issued treasury notes and created a market for it. So that was essential. It was, that act was thrown out in 1871, and it didn't come back till 1913, of course. But, you know, this is one of the debates we still face, is like, how much should states do? They don't have the capital to do it. So that's the main problem. How do they raise the capital? Obviously, the federal government has the ability to print money, issue treasury notes, things like that. And they have the ability to gain more money through taxes than the states ever did. And this is an important footnote. When Lincoln and Douglas and the Illinois legislature voted to create the Illinois Central Railroad and the Illinois-Michigan Canal, the country went into recession the following year. And the state went broke. I mean, they had to stop work on all of it. And they had no ability to raise more capital until the recession ended. And of course, foreign investors came in. But, you know, that's how a lot of this got financed, is like, you know, investors from Germany, from England, came in with private money. And even Eisenhower fought to some degree this idea that there should be, you know, the Federal Highway Act. And you know, even though he had seen in Germany how good the roads were, and he wanted this system so that, you know, hey, if we had to move troops from, say, you know, Akron, Ohio to, you know, the West Coast, we kind of need some good roads to do that. So this is our debate right now. And I think it's a good one. And I think that people who are thinking about this see this as another form of creating more economic opportunity and to some degree more economic equality.
Right. Well, this is a different way that I think the most people look at Lincoln, but it helps to get the full picture and then also understand how these debates today have been happening for a long time and how they've been addressed throughout history. So there's a lot more to unpack in your book. And for listeners who want to check it out, it's called Lincolnomics: How President Lincoln Constructed the Great American Economy. John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.